Berlin is a time travel machine. I mean, it is a place that feels in a way stuck in the past. It's got such a lived in past that's so strong to many of us who have been watching like documentaries about World War II, and you know, like its recent past is so tumultuous and so well known that for that reason, there's a lot of tourism that is about the past, but then just generally, economically and socially, it also feels stuck in the past. It's not unusual to see somebody with a literal mohawk. Everybody is wearing Adidas tracksuits from the 90s, which is a big thing in the movie.
Greetings, slow divers. It is your caffeinated host, Farida, along with my producer, Drew, with another fun film conversation. Today on The Slow Dive, we're joined by writer and director Emily Manti, a storyteller whose work moves fluidly between documentary, narrative film, and thoughtful long-form journalism. Emily is a spiritual, values-led artist who brings faith, philosophy, and a deep curiosity about the human experience into everything she creates. With a master's in theology and ethics from the University of Edinburgh, she crafts multicultural stories that bridge the sacred and the secular, inviting audiences into narratives that are both introspective and beautifully alive. Her films and NGO-driven documentaries have screened across the U.S. and Europe, earning audience awards, supporting grassroots organizations, and sparking conversations with international NGOs. She's taught writing and filmmaking in South Asia, co-produced a podcast series, Techno Spiritual Crossings, and published work with outlets including the Huffington Post, the Daily Beast, and Deutsche Welle. Emily's debut feature, Berlin Loop, a crime-tinged, time-bending, coming-of-age thriller, won the Audience Award at the 2025 Berlin Sci-Fi Film Fest. The film follows a disillusioned young cleaning woman who falls into Berlin's bike theft underworld and becomes trapped in a looping cycle of revenge, greed, and self-reckoning. It's a gritty, mysterious fable that echoes the pulse of Run, Lola, Run and the attention of Emily the Criminal. In today's conversation, we will dive into the spirit of indie filmmaking, how Berlin Loop came to life, and Emily's vision for the future of storytelling. It's a rich, reflective exploration of craft and story, so let's dive in. Welcome, Emily.
Wow, thanks, Farida. Thank you so much for having me, and thanks for that introduction.
I know. Thank you for joining us. I am so excited to, let's talk. I mean, really great film. But as you know, our first segment is the icebreaker question. So if you could describe your current chapter in life in three words, what would they be?
Oh boy, I guess that's three words. Current chapter in life is intuitive, intentional, and impact-driven.
Nice. Intuitive, impactful, impact-driven, and intentional. I like that. Three I's. Put that on a t-shirt. That's good.
There you go. Branding all the time.
What are you currently listening to? What's on your Spotify playlist? What is your music choice right now? What's a song that's on repeat or an album you can't get enough of?
I recently rediscovered my iPod Shuffle that I've had since about 2008. And it has on it an album that I really love. That's the best of U2 from 1980 to 1990. And it has all these B-sides that I had never heard before I got that album. And there's one called Walk to the Water that I have had in my head for the last several days. So,
You too. I love you too. You know, I actually just came across, it's funny you mentioned you too. I was out somewhere and they had the music in the overhead and they were playing Helter Skelter and it was U2's version, not Beatles.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I was like, wait, did they ever do a Helter Skelter? And they did. And I was
that's on the best sides, B-sides. Cause there's one record that's like all of the hits that you recognize from the '80s. And then there's another record that's all the B-sides. And
nice.
That was my big discovery when I found those B-sides.
I know.
I was just a young child in the 80s. I was not listening to U2 at that time. I had never bought a record album of U2. Mm-hmm. They did Helter Skelter. That's on that album as well. That best.
Wow. Cool. Okay. Well, I love U2. Love U2. Okay. How are you spending Thanksgiving in Berlin? Because I know you're in Berlin, so
well,
for our guests and audience.
Usually, I go to a friend's Thanksgiving or I have a Thanksgiving, but this year I actually have no plan, or I have no Thanksgiving plans, but over the weekend, there are a few of my friends having like all-day birthday parties, which seem like sort of alternative Friendsgiving. One of the friends is German, one is Indian, so they're going to be very multi-cult, as we say in Germany, multikulti, Thanksgiving fests.
Yeah, I love that. So you said all day birthday celebration?
Yes.
Wow. That's the way to do it. I mean, that's the way to do it. That's the right way to celebrate your birthday.
Yeah.
Okay, well, while you're having your all day birthday celebration / Friendsgiving, let's go on to our first segment and talk about how an American filmmaker ended up in Germany. When you look back at the beginning of your creative path, what were the early moments or the influences that drew you to filmmaking, and how did you end up where you are? Like, what was that whole process like?
I mean, I guess I've always been coming to Germany. I always watched movies as a kid. There was one summer when I was 12 that I saw Star Wars. I fell in love with making movies, or the idea of making movies and being in movies. And I started watching Hitchcock movies, and I decided to make my own film. And I forced my cousins to be in the movie. I forced my mom to be in the movie. I forced everybody to be in the movie. And that was like my entire summer when I was 12. And so since then, I've been making movies. And then I just sort of like, you know, self-studied all of the great directors. And I think the first German director that I ever saw a movie from was Wim Wenders. And I probably saw Paris, Texas as one of the first ones, which is like, still one of my most favorite movies. But I also saw this movie called The Million Dollar Hotel that he made in 2001. No, around then, with the same cinematographer that he usually uses, Robbie Mueller. Mm-hmm. And actually, U2 did the soundtrack, and it was co-written by Bono. So yeah, back to U2 there. And it takes place in downtown LA. And it was in the era where there was nothing in downtown LA. And it stars Mel Gibson. And the movie, I think, was pretty universally panned. It's not one of Wim Wenders' best films, but it combined a couple of things. It was, for me, it was a look at Los Angeles, the center of filmmaking, that was completely different. Talked about these sort of SRO places where homeless or homeless adjacent people live. Everybody in the film like lived in this former hotel that was sort of in ruins. And all the characters had some sort of a disability or like mental illness or something like that. And so they were sort of like society's rejects. And it had a great jazz soundtrack. And all of these things, like the beauty and the ugliness together, the sort of alternative, like look at people in society who are marginalized and just silenced most of the time. Mm-hmm. And putting that in a place where movies are made and dreams are made, I think that movie really captures a lot of what I like about making movies. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the inspirations and influences that I've had. I mean, I lived in LA for a long time. I always had this fascination with Germany, with Wim Wenders, later Tom Tykwer also, who is the director of Run Lola Run, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, through that, it just sort of grew and built. So
yeah. So tell me, so obviously as a child, you definitely were into storytelling and filmmaking, but like what brought you into theology as a study? And then that this like, cause I'm seeing that there's a lot of reflection in your work, your creative work, but like, what was that decision? Like with that degree and that background, and then you worked in the actual film industry in LA in the art department, right? As a, so like, what was that like, I guess, what was that shift like? And what was the moment or the pivot where you're like, you know, I need to go full force and like go into filmmaking and try that now. I mean, you liked it, but I mean, how does, I'm trying to understand the background in your education and that, because I don't think you need to go to film school to be a filmmaker. You really don't. But I'm just curious, like, was that, did that inform any of your filmmaking dreams?
Well, I always had the idea that I was going to go to film school. Mm-hmm. And I always wanted to make films, and that was my thing. I also grew up in a conservative Christian family. And so I always had like a very strong curiosity too about faith beyond just, you know, what I was told, like, you know, a drive to know, really to understand and to, well, yeah, a drive to understand at that point. And so I applied to USC Film School and NYU Film School, and I was like, done. And I didn't get in to either one. So I was like, what do I do? What do I do next? I had, luckily my parents forced me to apply to a couple of backup schools. My backup school was Azusa Pacific University, which is a Christian liberal arts college in Southern California. And so I had two cousins that went there. I decided to go there. I was not excited at all. They had a communications major that had just turned into kind of a film. They had a film emphasis in that major. So I started with that major, and I minored in theology just because I was curious. I was curious about philosophy and theology. Mm-hmm. Also via movies, in a way. There was another movie that really influenced me called 13 Conversations About One Thing. And yes. the director was a philosophy major. And I thought, oh yeah, if I could do something like that, if I could access films in a way that, you know, really makes people think, because those are the kind of films that I like to watch, that'd be great. So I very quickly changed my major from cinema, which was this like cinema emphasis, I guess, in the communication department, to theology. And then I just continued to take the production classes and make movies and take the theology classes. And I continued on with that. I graduated from there with theology. And then I worked for about a year in LA, or a couple years. And I decided to get a master's because I felt like, you know, when you graduate from school, whatever you major in, you're 21, 22 years old, you don't know that much about the world. And I thought, I don't have anything to say. I want to make movies, but I don't want to just make them to put some content out. I want to make movies with a message and a meaning, and I want to have them have something to say. So I thought, well, maybe I should just continue studying theology and philosophy. And eventually I will figure out what it is that I want to say.
Yeah, no, I think you made a really important statement there because I mean, when we're younger in our creative journeys, there's only so much we can draw from. And the more lived in experience we have, the more inspiration we draw from different subjects that interest us. Yeah, they do make more developed characters, more developed storylines. Mm-hmm. And I see that that's one of the beautiful things about writers and directors in as they get older, their work just, it's a whole other level of work. It's not topical and it's more, and I do think that's a really good intentional choice because you said you're basing your life in intention. So that was really good that you were still so very intentional about what you wanted to make. And I think the other thing is what I heard is like, you knew what kind of films you wanted to make. And so it seems like you like something meaningful and reflective. Am I right about that?
Yeah, I knew that the films that were most meaningful to me were films that had sort of something to say more than just like just a story, even though just a story is great. But I knew that was a big part of it for me, like what they have.
Obviously, you've mentioned a lot about the German filmmakers that inspired you, maybe perhaps shaped you to move to Germany as well. Can you share a moment in Berlin that made you feel like I belong here creatively, like a moment that signaled like this is where I'm going to like create and do more filmmaking? Was there a moment?
Well, before I moved to Berlin, I had visited a couple of times. I went to Berlinale and the European Film Market one year on this like young filmmaker program. And after I did that, I said, I want to come back and make a short film. And I knew like maybe two or three people, and I got a producer on board to help me. And I wrote the script. I came back and I made that film. And just the way that people kind of opened their arms to help me when I didn't even live there, I didn't know anything about it. And the line producer, her name was Anna Winkler, she set up all these auditions for me. And she just made it happen because she's just a fantastic person. And I was like, wow, I feel so supported here in a way that I never felt supported that way making short films in LA. It always felt like, because I had worked on a lot of films and then I'd made some of my own short films, and it felt like such a, you know, pushing a huge boulder uphill and everybody telling mm-hmm. you why you couldn't do it. And in Berlin, it felt like, if people are interested in the idea, they're interested in co-creating it. And that mm. was true of the actors who, to this day, I'm still friends with two of those actors. One of them taught me the German language. And actually, he called me 2 days ago and asked me to come visit. So I think that's where I felt like the belonging, the collaborative co-creating that happens in the arts here.
Wonderful. So yeah, so each place kind of shaped your filmmaking a little differently. LA, you're inspired by the culture, you're at Azusa, you're thinking like, what should I do? And then that led you to Germany, where you felt like the environment was more collaborative, it was easier for independent film to like at least get started.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is why now we have to talk about your first feature, Berlin Loop. So the world of Berlin Loop is a film that blends crime, coming of age storytelling, and time travel to explore what happens. It follows a disillusioned young cleaning woman whose impulsive decision to steal a bike pulls her into Berlin's underground. It's part thriller, part fable, where Run Lola Run meets Emily the criminal. Emily Manti, what drove you to write this? It touches on like what were some of the social issues and like what was the genesis of the story? Like, how did Berlin Loop come about?
Well, there's so many. My friend Meredith always says I struggle. I never struggle for a lack of ideas. Like, there's always too many themes and there could be a few less. And themes kind of like struggle for prominence. And this movie started out with like half of the emphasis was on gentrification and real estate, and half of the emphasis was on like petty crime. And it became much more about the bikes and the bike crime, and the gentrification had to take a back seat, but it's still there. Mm-hmm. It used to be there in a much bigger anti-Airbnb way.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I saw a lot of, it was during the pandemic, and I just like, you know, I had spent already about 5 years in Berlin, and I was just kind of taking time noticing things. And there were some big themes that like immediately came out to me in Berlin. Berlin is a city that has historically been divided. There's the communist capitalist divide of the Cold War. There's the actual physical divide of the city. It's like a working class city that is now being kind of invaded by multinationalism in a way mm-hmm. that it never was because of this Cold War divide. It is a city of working class people that has this like very DIY culture. And it also is like trying to become really attractive to tech companies and international investment and all that kind of stuff in a way that like maybe other cities in Germany are more so.
Mm-hmm.
And all of these kind of intersections just makes it a really kind of weedy place.
What were you, as a writer and director of this Berlin Loop, what were you highlighting through Fatima's journey, her character?
I wanted to look for a Berlin character that I hadn't seen a lot of.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, of course, there are many German movies that don't make it anywhere internationally, but all of the international German movies that I'd seen, they focus on the Cold War or World War II, or they focus on the journeys of just like very, like the regular German. They're all very white. They're very, very white. And there's a huge Turkish German population. And I really wanted to highlight somebody who in this city, like outside of the city, would be totally invisible, even though it's such a huge part of German society and Berlin's culture. Both Turkish Germans and just international people, like the city is made up of at least, I think it's about 45% foreign born, or their parents were foreign born kind of people. So it makes up a huge part of Berlin, and it's just like it's never seen beyond the like, you know, hip international expat person. But like, I wanted to show somebody who's German, who's born in Germany, who's really German, but is just like ethnically not the stereotypical German. And I wanted to show the way that she is on the bottom of the system, but is also kind of very regular in the system. And kind of piece apart how she can see herself as a victim and see herself as a victor, and how she can be on both sides of that, and not kind of saying poor Fatma, like she's you know, a hard up person and she's always going to have bad luck because of racism and whatever, but like a person who can really like has all the skills to rise above that, but in so doing, in the setup of the society, becomes the part of society that she hated at the beginning. So I wanted to send a, like, look at that kind of, this kind of ladder that we see that is in the movie in a lot of different ways. These like levels of development or progress and how they end up transforming people into, how not recognizing the things that were good about their lives before allows them to just sort of forget who they are.
You guys just finished your North American tour of Berlin Loop here earlier this year, and you've gone to film festivals. How has Fatima's character, her grit, her role as a female-led protagonist in this film, and also the film, how has it been received by the audience? What have you heard? Especially for those who have not seen it yet, it is in German. So, I mean, how was that received, like, especially here in North America?
I mean, she's so expressive. People really like her, the actress, Daria Akyol. This was her debut leading performance in a film. She's just fantastic. So people really like her, the actress, and the character. I think it's kind of surprising to people, because you're at one point you sympathize with her. A lot of people told me I sympathize with her in ways that I didn't think that I would. And I think that like she has that charm about her as an actress and as a character that it kind of gives you this push pull where you sympathize with her and then you're like, she's just kind of a jerk.
Yeah.
So I think people really got on board with that, and they really liked her. And I think that, like, you know, you really need a very singular type of actor who can pull that off. Because she's not a likable character all the time. She has all these scenes with her social worker, and the social worker is giving her good advice, but, you know, in a way too, you know, motherly way. And she's just not having it at all. And you're like, eventually you should listen to her. You should just listen to her.
Yeah, no, but you know, I think you did a really great job, Emily, with showing the complexity of human personality and human nature, that not everyone is all good or all bad, and not every situation in a circumstance, especially socioeconomic, like there has to be a, I think when we approach characters like this, where you're kind of like you said, push or pull, like you can kind of empathize like why they're doing the thing that they shouldn't be doing, because you have the empathy to understand where they are in the quote system, right? Yeah. So I think that's why I really like it. It is a complicated character, but it makes sense because you do feel a range of emotions and you can see both sides of the issue. So I think for that reason, I think you did a really great job like in developing that.
I wanted that to be with every character, where it's like, we see ourselves on two sides of a binary, but everybody has a perspective, and everybody wants something. And most of the time we want the same things. Mm-hmm. It's just like, we're approaching it as if it's a zero sum game. Like, you know, if I win, you know, if I lose, you win, and I don't want that. And I think like what we really need to figure out is that like everybody can win in some way. If we change our definition of winning to be like, you have to lose in order for me to win.
I love that. Love that. Also, the loop. What is the loop function as a metaphor? Like, what were you thinking when you were thinking time travel? Does the loop, besides actually, it actually is a literal time travel situation and she's being looped in, but did that serve something else that we're missing, or maybe some of us did get? I mean, I'm just curious. There was a metaphor.
I really feel like Berlin is a time travel machine. I mean, it is a place that feels in a way stuck in the past. It's got such a lived in past that's so strong to many of us who have been watching like documentaries about World War II. And its recent past is so tumultuous and so well known that for that reason, there's a lot of tourism that is about the past. But then just generally, economically and socially, it also feels stuck in the past. Like, it's not unusual to see somebody with a literal mohawk. I mean, I went to a comedy show a couple of weeks ago, and there were three people with mohawks in the audience.
Amazing.
That just, everybody is wearing Adidas tracksuits from the 90s, which is a big thing in the movie.
Because no, that's about to, that was one life. Of my questions. That was one of my questions. But yes, go ahead.
It just exists so much in this city. So there are a lot of things that like made it seem like a time travel that would be very easy to accomplish in Berlin, because you wouldn't have to change anything about the visual appeal of the city.
Yeah.
So that was one thing. And then I thought like the vehicle of a time loop really, I mean, well, there's a bicycle loop that's sort of, it's two circles that work together, but it also is just a vehicle to tell a story that does have a moral. When you have a time loop and you have a chance to do things again, and and I wrote it during the pandemic, we were all thinking about like, it felt like living in a time loop at that point. It was like, now we have masks. Now we have no masks. Now we have rules. Now we have no rules. Now we have rules again. So that there were a lot of things about just like the loops that we're constantly stuck in, and what happens if we get another chance, and do we do anything different, and do we actually improve things, or is an improvement for one person like, you know, detrimental to another person? So I was just interested in all those kinds of things.
No, I really like that. I think it does serve as a reflective film, because physically she's in a time warp and she's looping, but at the same time, like, it's also like her tests and trials of like figuring out what she needs to do next. And that is very reflective to just the audience, because we've all been there in some quandary in our life where we're like, we need to do something different.
And sometimes the different thing is just stop replaying the past. It doesn't have to go like the past. It doesn't have to, you don't have to go back there. Like, you can just move forward.
Yes.
And I think that's a big cycle that we seem to be trapped in. Just relitigating the past again and again and again and again, and reliving the past, and sometimes like recreating the traumas of the past. because we feel like there's injustice, but it's by going backwards, we're not going to actually solve it.
Yeah. Well, I do want to also talk about the whole process, or at least parts of the process that you learned in making your first feature. Because also, you know, you had a producing partner and team. And when you look back at Berlin Loop, from the first idea to Picture Lock, what were some of the, I guess, challenges early on that you were able to overcome in this independent feature, which is your first feature as well, Emily?
I mean, I think the first challenge was internal. I had wanted to make a feature for a long time. I'd written a lot of scripts. They were all set in exotic locations where I didn't live and had no resources. And that made them, you know, expensive. They were all written from a place of curiosity. And I had to think, like, how can I be curious about the place that I live in the most localized way that will allow me to actually make something for, I don't want to say for nothing, but for something that I can afford to do. And in the end, I was able to self-finance it. And so it was extremely low budget. And I had spent the previous 5 years going to like filmmaker meetups where we just like made short films. And some of the actors were even from that. One of the co-producers was from those meetups. And We had been in these networks where you just like use the resources that you have and the people that you have and just make films. And I loved that approach, which was just like, I don't need everything to be perfect in order to do it. I'm just going to do it. And I think like it's sometimes your own desire for, you know, perfection. And it's your ego that says, well, if it's not perfect, then I don't want my name to be on it, or I don't want to put it out there into the world if it's not, you know, if it's not going to win awards or whatever. But so I had to conquer that facet of myself that just wanted all the conditions to be perfectly met the way that I wanted them to be met, and have a producer to like come in and save me and do everything for me. And I just had to acknowledge that I was the one holding myself back from doing it.
Wow. That's very important that you shared that. There's so many people that just need to just make the movie, which is, tell us about Just Make the Movie.
Yeah. A lot of people started asking me about the process while I was making it and right after. And I started a newsletter to just keep people informed on the post-production, which then obviously like on a small movie, it just takes a long time. You've got like five people essentially helping you on their spare time, more or less. And so after I wrote that newsletter, and people like a year, 2 years after kept on asking me about it, I ended up putting together this little like email course. It's just like five emails that arrive subsequently every day for 5 days. That's called Just Make the Movie. And it's for indie filmmakers who are just looking for some encouragement and inspiration, or people who are just interested in independent film and like, how does it happen? How does it work? How does it get done? And so I just shared like my greatest lessons and insights on, well, I mean, the mindset thing, which is a big thing that I mentioned, like how I got the equipment and how you, I'm talking about hiring people, how you get like really gather a good team, and kind of some of the things that indie filmmakers often overlook. And I feel like the time that I spent in LA was such an amazing training ground for me, because it's like the technical base of the people who are not just talented, but technically very skilled. And I learned, I mean, I worked in art department on a lot of movies with first-time directors, and I learned a lot of things just from watching them direct, from how they interacted with their teams, sometimes positively, sometimes not. And I also learned like what it's like in the below-the-line departments and the amount of people that it takes to make things happen, and how teams can work together well and what makes them not work together well. And so when I was writing it and when I was making it, I knew what was possible. And I also knew what was possible within my team and the resources that I had. Some of them came from the universities, and I had worked with them before at the university. And I knew, you know, I knew from the art department, like what was going to be possible for us to do with the locations mm-hmm. that we had. A lot of the locations were just like friends' houses and places that I knew were safe for us to be. And so I think all that knowledge of just the way the entire ecosystem works, mm-hmm. I like, you know, if you haven't been to film school or if you haven't worked on a lot of other people's sets, I think it's hard to have that knowledge. Like that is just, that's part of the experience that I needed to build in order for me yeah. to make this happen. And I know a lot of first-time directors, when I was working in LA, there were first-time directors that had never done any of that stuff. And they had, you know, a rich friend who just gave them the money, and they didn't really know, you know, maybe they weren't also producing, or they had producers that were sort of filling some of their knowledge gaps. But I think if you're doing a micro budget indie, it's really important that you know every part of the process. And there were things that I very much, I thought that I knew, but like when it came to post-production, that I was also learning for the first time with a really small team.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's really important to underscore for anyone who's interested in making a film, their first feature or short film, is that it helps if you are on the set and you're shadowing or you're just working in any capacity or part of a project, because you're going to learn yeah. through experience and yeah, just spending that time on set, like that's knowledge that's very, like that is a experience that really does help one formulate their game plan to tackle their own directorial film debut. And also justmakethemovie.com, it's great for someone who wants to like check out and be inspired and learn through that. And I encourage people, so this is my philosophy as like a producer, and I speak to like really amazing directors like yourself and a lot of other directors I've worked with, is that you can't always throw money at a problem. Okay. Right. So that's the thing.
Well, you like, can, if, but it doesn't always
I mean,
work.
You can. But for me, the way I see creativity is like, how much can you do with constraints and little and still make a successful, beautiful, entertaining visual film? And that to me, it's like, okay, if someone can do this with like $100,000, and mm-hmm. write a great story mm-hmm. and great mm-hmm. and have like no name talent that are just amazing performers. That's their first time on screen. And they can do that so well on a very small budget, a very lean crew, and still produce something emotionally compelling and resonant. That is successful to me. Because if you can do that with little, imagine what you could do with VFX money. All the licensing mm-hmm. of your soundtrack, more yeah. amazing talent. So I think I feel like from a producer's perspective, like I think all directors need to make micro budgets, low budget films, and all kinds of films to just get that experience to get better with every film, I think. And I think that's yeah. why I really appreciate indie film, because we do come together and collaborate and produce beautiful stories on screen with very little. And it's all passion, because, you know, if the budgets are small, people are coming together for the merit of the project or the story or the director's vision. So for me, yeah. as a film festival goer too, like I love seeing what independent film is doing. Cause that's, to me, it's like, if you can do that with this little, imagine what Sony money or this Apple TV money or any of that money could do for you. It'd be amazing. I want to give you that loan.
The constraints create a stylistic language that the filmmaker maybe didn't know they had. I mean, I watched this great debut last year called Mad Bills to Pay that was shot in New York, and every scene was a one take. So it was very mise-en-scène based. It was beautifully shot, and it was really highlighting the performances, and that it's been so successful in the festival circuit, even though it was a tiny, tiny movie to produce, because it forced the director to really like engage with a style that was going to also suit the budget and the, you know, the time frame and all the constraints of the project.
Yeah.
I also wanted to mention one more thing. I think another big reason to like make a movie, make a like a low budget indie and do it yourself is to have this, like, I have this sort of like two-pronged vision of impact. And part of it is what happens in the movie, having a message and a meaning and maybe talking about social issues or something like that. But behind the camera, I think, is just as important, because, you know, what I learned working on a lot of independent movies is that it's very common. Even before Me Too, it was just sort of a given that not only were a lot of women sexually abused or harassed, but just in general, the vast power difference between a producer and a PA would mean that anybody who is above a PA can sort of mistreat them in various ways.
Mm-hmm.
From saying like, okay, well, the PAs are all working 20 hours a day, because they have to be there before everybody gets there to like set up breakfast and crafty, because we're too low budget to actually have a crafty person or to have a breakfast person. And then they're also the last people to leave, and they have to drop off the cast, and they have to do this. And it's very easy to get into a dynamic where you just accept that like these people just get treated horribly, because that's the dues that you have to pay. And that's exactly the language of it. You have to pay your dues. But it's just not treating people with humanity or respect. And I think, like, if you've worked on all levels of that indie world and then you are producing something that's indie, I think it's incumbent on you to pay that forward to yourself that was probably mistreated as a PA on a movie before, and make sure that doesn't happen to your PAs, and make sure that everybody feels fairly treated and they work humane hours and they're able to get rest at night and they can actually like have a good meal. I mean, I think it's critically important, and I think every indie filmmaker will say it's critically important to serve good food to your crew on your movie. Like, that is one of one of the most important things you can do for your crew on a day-to-day basis, is serve them like good food that they want to eat, that it's going to power them through the day. But I think also finishing on time.
I think that
is important to me in the impact of a film, that it shouldn't just be in front of the camera and the story, but it should also be behind the scenes.
No, absolutely. I think it goes back to the three words I asked you earlier. You said intentional, and it is being intentional and mindful of everyone on set and having that practice in all areas, right? Like as a producer, as a director in general, very important, because it is we all have had those experiences that are not so wonderful on set, and we've seen those workplace situations where it could end, can really hurt someone's emotional health. I was going to say, we're almost out of time, Emily, but on the future of storytelling, I want to just quickly ask you, what is your thoughts on vertical dramas and these mobile first narratives, and also the use of AI? So those two things.
Use of AI, I would say creative people are always going to create, and they're going to just keep on creating. Whatever else happens with AI, I feel like it would be a much better use of our resources to not take jobs away from people who want to do these jobs, but to instead spend it on things that maybe people don't want to do. That seems like a much better use of resources to me. And I don't know, I will always be a human-powered creator, and I'm not gonna steal other people's work or the square root of the internet in order to make work. But I also can't stop anybody else from doing that, because I guess that people kind of feel like it's inevitable. And I'm like, well, it's only inevitable if you choose to make it so. And for me, I'm just not choosing to make it an inevitable part of my creative world. On vertical dramas, I don't have a really strong opinion on the, you know, portrait mode in general, but I guess I have a stronger opinion about like the depth of stories. Stories can be any length, but I think people's attention spans have really shrunk, and that is a shame. And when you sit down and watch a good film, or even if you're like binging a series that has really amazing character development, you're involved in a way that's much stronger than if you're watching something a minute at a time and just kind of scrolling past. It's engaging more of your senses if you're spending a longer time with it. And, you know, maybe horizontal mode. I mean, it is true that we're sort of both in portrait mode here, and also we're close-ups, or, you know, head and shoulders close-ups, and you can show more in horizontal or in vertical if you step back, but maybe horizontal is better for actually getting the scope of things.
Yeah, well, I just, you know, obviously we here at The Slow Dive, we love long form. So we're constantly pushing back on the attention span and telling people to read books, to write, to journal, to create, to go make pottery, to stay in community. And that's like the antidote to this massive acceleration through technology and instant gratification. So I'm with you on that. And I really love what you said, human powered. Because there is no substitute for the warmth and the human element in any of the works. So that is what I think as creatives, but I do see the use of AI where it makes sense, but not to replace the human connection with voiceover talent or musicians or storyboard artists or visual artists. That I think... But anyways, the one good thing I will say AI has produced for those who are listening is those cat internet AI memes. Have you seen them? They're just ridiculous. They're just so cute. I mean, I think that's where AI is good for, like, creating memes. Like, stay out of the motion picture, stay out of films, but it's fun for, like, you know, you see a weightlifting orange cat and you're like, what? You ran off with the car. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's all over the internet, those cat memes.
Yeah, I stay away from the AI cat memes. I mean, my dad sent me a video the other day, like a salacious YouTube video, you know, like with those like clickbait titles. And I clicked on it and it was just like an AI generated guy telling a story. And the voice was not even actually matching the lips at all. And I was like, Dad, did you know this is AI generated? And he was like, yeah, but the story could still be true. And I'm like, no, this story is generated, like, for most clicks. And I don't know. I just, the internet has a lot of stuff.
Yeah,
and I think even in your title, like, this is The Slow Dive. And I think the more things there are and the more we focus on the speed of making things, like, oh, if I could, instead of taking 2 years to make a movie, why don't I make 6 movies in 2 years? Or why don't I make 15? Mm-hmm. Or why don't I make 50? Well, you could, but what's the purpose?
Yeah.
What's the meaning? What is the meaning of having more? You know, like, what's the intention?
Yeah. Yeah, no, well said. Okay, our last question of the day. If you could offer your younger self one insight about resilience, what would it be?
Wow. I think I would tell my younger self that I'm not competing with anybody to win any, you know, speed prizes. Take the time that needs to be taken and don't try to rush out of things. You're there because it's your time to be there.
Love that. Well, Berlin Loop comes to Vimeo on demand on December 25th. And I will be linking Berlin Loop and your free guerrilla filmmaking guide, justmakethemovie.com, and your newsletter for emilymantai.com as well in our full episode guide. Thank you, Emily, for joining us today. This was such a great conversation. And I encourage everybody to watch Berlin Loop. It's a really interesting and fun and really well done movie. I think you guys did a great job. We didn't even cover the Adidas tracksuits.
No,
but we didn't get there. But thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having this. Thanks for doing this podcast and for spotlighting independent filmmakers and for supporting independent filmmakers. I mean, you and I are working on a project right now, and
yes,
it's going to be awesome. Yes.
It is. It's going to be great. Well, friends, till next time, I'm Farida. You are listening to The Slow Dive Podcast. Make time to listen, reflect, and connect.
Thanks for listening to The Slow Dive. please be sure to subscribe and give us a positive review wherever you get your podcasts. The Slow Dive is hosted by Farida Rafiq and edited by Drew Franzblau. Our theme music is Dive by Sea Rogue.